Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. One in five Americans own a wearable activity tracker. One in 10 actually uses theirs. You've probably heard of the Fitbit, Jawbone Up, and Nike Fuel Band. They are used to track daily steps, calories, and sleep patterns. The end goal for many is better health and weight loss. New research published in the Journal of the American Medical Association has cast a shadow, however, over those prospects. Joining us by phone is the study's lead author and director of the Physical Activity and Weight Management Research Center at the University of Pittsburgh, Dr. John Jakasik. Welcome to the show.
Right. Thanks for having me today.
What interested you in studying the effectiveness of fitness trackers in the first place?
Well, a number of years ago when we first started this study, about 5 years ago or so, these activity trackers were just kind of starting to kind of gain a lot of traction in the marketplace. A lot of people were talking about them. And, you know, we have a pretty effective weight management program, but there's always ways to make it more effective. And so we were thinking that, hey, you know, these things, if we add them to what already appears to be pretty effective, may actually make it more effective and have more people successful. Unfortunately, when we added these devices to our weight management program, it actually hurt the weight loss as opposed to help the weight loss.
What's the theory about why fitness trackers are supposed to work? What's the theory behind it?
Well, the whole idea behind these kind of, you know, activity devices that monitor your activity throughout the day and give you feedback is that if you can, it gives you information, and if you look down and see, you know, where you are for the course of the day, that will spur you on to, oh, I'm not very active today. I better get up and move around a little bit more. I'm short of the goal that's been set for me. I need to get up and move a little bit more. So the whole premise is that by it kind of prompting you to, hey, get up and do something, that you're just simply going to respond to that and it's going to work.
But?
Not always. You know, that doesn't always work. That works for some people. It's kind of like putting your running shoes out at night. If I see them, I'm going to be likely to put them on and go out for a run. But that doesn't always work, you know, either. The treadmill sitting in front of your television. If you see it, you might get on it and walk. It doesn't always work. So I think this idea that, you know, it's not as simple as just prompting people to do it. There's other reasons why people are not responding to those kinds of prompts.
So how did you conduct the research?
So we recruited about 470 young adults, 18 to 35 years of age, which has been an understudied group of people when it comes to weight management. But we also thought that group, that age group, might be kind of more amenable to use of technology, more comfortable with it.
Yeah, so you didn't want it to be the reason they're not using it is because they're old fogies kind of a thing.
Yeah, we didn't want, you know, somebody, you know, oh, what is that? I don't want to wear that kind of thing. We conducted a 2-year intervention with each one of them. They got our strong weight management program, which in Pittsburgh we think we do a pretty good job with. And after we got people to lose weight for 6 months, half of them at that point then got the activity tracker and the other half did not. And then we kept working with them through the end of 24 months.
And what did you find?
So we found that, you know, everybody did really well initially, which we always know that will happen. The challenge is not losing the weight, it's keeping the weight off. And after they lost the weight, there was some weight regain between 6 and 24 months. However, that weight regain was much larger in the group that we gave the activity tracker to compared to the group that didn't get the activity tracker, which was a complete surprise because we were hoping for just the opposite.
Well, I was expecting maybe it would be about the same, that there wouldn't be an advantage, but you're saying there was maybe some sort of disadvantage?
Yeah, there was some disadvantage, and it's hard to figure out exactly what was going on there, but we have some ideas, and one of those ideas is that, you know, when it comes to weight management, there's so many things that are important. Watching what you're eating, when you're eating, your sleep, your activity, stress, all those things impact. But putting an activity tracker on someone may simply put such a focus on pay attention to what this device is telling you, and if it says you're doing okay, you're fine. And that may have caused people to kind of lessen their interest or lessen their focus on other behaviors that are really important. Hey, if the activity tracker says I'm okay, I'm okay. When in fact, they may have been saying, if I'm okay, I can eat another hamburger. Look how active I am. I can eat another cupcake. Maybe that wasn't the best thing for them to be doing.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about activity trackers, you know, the kinds that measure the number of steps and consider your sleep patterns at night. If you have a question or comment about that, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. There are probably people out there who disagree with Dr. John Jakasik is saying right now. He's director of physical activity and weight management research center at the University of Pittsburgh. So tell us what your experience has been, if it's been different than this. 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Dr. Jakasik, there probably are some people for whom activity trackers are perfect for them.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, if we look deep into our own data, you know, we have 470 people. Of course, it worked well for some. And understand, we're not saying don't use them and they don't work for anyone. We're just saying be careful about expecting that all you need to do is put an activity tracker on and you don't have to pay attention to anything at that point in time. And, you know, and there are a number of people out there who, you know, who swear by them. And so my message is, if you have an activity tracker, it's helping you to be physically active, it's encouraging you, and things are going well, by all means, keep using it. If you feel like you want an activity tracker, go ahead and get one. Just understand that in addition to just putting this thing on, you actually have to pay attention to all the other things in your life that make it a healthy lifestyle. And I guess the last thing is if this, it, you know, we focused on weight, but it's very possible that, you know, if you focus just on activity, that it is working for that. And even if you don't lose weight, even if you're overweight, there is a lot of health benefits to being physically active. So, you know, by all means, use them for how you see they best help you, but don't think that this is the magic bullet.
In your research, you found that among the young adults with a body mass index between 25 and 40, which is high, the addition of the wearable technology resulted in weight loss. It worked for that particular group. Is that because they were highly motivated?
You know, that's the whole thing. You know, people are coming forward saying, "Yes, I want to engage in weight loss. Yes, I need to do it." And I think that it's this is a unique, you know, unique group of people because they're willing to kind of engage. There's a lot of people out there who aren't willing to engage in a program like this and just feel like they can do it on their own. And so we really don't know how effective these things are for those individuals. And again, for every one person that it works for, there may be another person where it doesn't work as effectively for. So you have to kind of weigh and balance, you know, how you feel this will work in with your health goals and what you're trying to accomplish.
Right. So the activity tracker, do you know more about what people actually use when they do use one? Is it the steps? Is it the sleep pattern thing?
I think it can be all of the above. I think the easiest thing for people to understand, the general person, is, you know, how many steps am I getting? What does that mean? And I think that that's one of the challenges with technology is technology can give us so much information. And sometimes if you don't know what to do with that technology or with that information, it becomes confusing. It's like information that I don't know what to do with. Like, I know in my own car, I'm driving my car and it's like, what do all these buttons do? I mean, I don't even need all this stuff. So I think what we need to understand is what information is most valuable to people, help them understand how to use that information to make the health-related changes that they're targeting. And I think that, you know, that's one of our challenges is we aren't doing that at this point in time.
Recent surveys show that people who use wearables tend to struggle with long-term engagement, that there it's a strategy for them. They're like, I can never keep at one thing. I'm going to try a wearable now and see if that helps.
Yeah, and I think for some people, especially now with, you know, the kind of social media piece that goes with a lot of them, you know, for some people who like that kind of community engagement, they like the little challenges that they create. Those are really great. But in our research, what we have found in different studies is we need to kind of keep that engagement changing every 3 to 6 months or people will lose interest. So if there's a challenge out there, a step challenge with your friends and family, every 3 to 6 months, you have to kind of engage in something a little new, a little different to keep this kind of going. Otherwise, it becomes stale, it becomes stagnant. So there is that challenge of just keeping people interested.
Why is that hard for people to stick with something?
I think there's a lot of – that's a billion-dollar question because every person's just a little bit different. But I think what ends up happening is that, you know, there's that initial kind of honeymoon period where, boy, look how much gain I'm getting. Look at the benefits that I'm getting from this. But at some point in time, what you're not doing is gaining something that you can feel on a day-to-day basis. it's helping something inside your body, but you don't see that and feel that every day.
Mm-hmm.
And so when that immediate feedback back wears off, people become less motivated. It's kind of like I get on the scale, my weight's going down. At some point, I'm doing all the right things, and the scale's no longer moving. It's not going down anymore. That's no longer motivating. It's not going up, but it's not going down. And so I think we need to find ways to kind of make sure that this information that these are giving people remains very motivating to them in some way.
Nils in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Nils.
Hey, and thanks for having me on. Really like your show.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment that this research study, the findings, doesn't really surprise me because I've thought about this for a while. It tracks your exercise, which is important. It is part of the equation. But in my experience, and I'm a fit guy, I try to stay active, but I know I can in one sitting eat 4 days worth of exercise, you know, or in one weekend drink a whole week's worth of exercise. And what I found that's been really helpful for myself and my family and friends is when you track your calories using like a MyFitnessPal app, because that is so much more a driver of weight loss or weight gain is the calories in, calories out, because you have to eat three meals a day no matter what. What you pick is so important. And I guess I just wanted to chime in that this makes sense. And I don't know, it's kind of something that I've been thinking about, but to hear a study kind of validated that, it's good to know. So I'll hang up. But yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Nils.
Well, it sounds like we should have just called your listener, and he would have told us not even to do the study. He had the answer, which is great. And I'm just kidding about that, but he's right. I mean, the one thing, though, about a lot of these activity trackers is that they also put into their software, into their app, some ability for individuals to track their calories. But mm-hmm. that becomes kind of a lesser piece of this. And people, you know, I think the wearable becomes the focus as opposed to the integration with the app that allows people to kind of track their intake and what they're eating and so on. And he's right. You know, you exercise for an hour, that's 300-400 calories. It's just one trip to the fast food restaurant and that can be wiped out. So we have got to be careful about telling people all they need to do is be physically active. There's more to it than that when it comes to this. And I'm an exercise advocate. Be active, but also you've got to pay attention to what you're eating.
Ann in Westerville, you're on the air with Dr. John Jakasik. Welcome to the show, Ann.
Hi. Just a little information for Dr. Jakasik. I'm 70 and my husband's 71, and we have a competition with our trackers to see who can get the most green stars. So it's helping us in that way. We don't pay a whole lot of attention to calories, although I think my husband would like to lose a little. But it's helped us as a huge competition.
Yeah, that's great. And I do think that, you know, for people that love the competition, for people that like the social component that comes with this,
mm-hmm.
this really helps because it's not like, you know, it's not like I can say, well, I walked today, you didn't walk. Here you actually can see it, and it becomes motivating. It, you know, it becomes this little competition. And I just want to know what she's going to get when she beats him at this competition.
What's the prize, Ann?
What's the prize?
Yeah.
Satisfaction of beating my husband.
Well, if he's a smart man, he's going to let you win regardless.
Right. Thank you, Ann, for that call. And Dr. John Jakasik, thanks to you for joining us today to talk about it.
Yeah, sure. No problem. Thanks for having me.
Dr. John Jakasik is the director of the Physical Activity and Weight Management Research Center at the University of Pittsburgh. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Anxiety is the most common mental health disorder in the United States. For some children, Anxiety is so debilitating that they can't make it to school, leave their parents' sight, or talk to new people. Over time, that level of anxiety interferes with friendships, work, and daily life. Dr. Kathleen Trainer, a child psychologist at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, has written a new book on the topic. It's entitled Calming Your Anxious Child, Words to Say and Things to Do. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show, Dr. Trainer.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be on the show.
What's the difference just between normal, I don't know, just normal worries and concerns and what is diagnosed as an anxiety disorder?
So normal anxiety, we all feel anxious at times. And children in particular, developmentally at different times, feel anxious, and that's within the normal range because it's transient and it does not interfere with their ability to function. When you have an anxiety disorder, it's kind of like the child is stuck in a state of anxiety over time, and it interferes with their functioning either at home, at school, and or with peers, or even academically.
What triggers these kinds of disorders?
Well, I think that there's a nature versus nurture aspect to it. I think that there's a lot of kids who biologically are predisposed to being anxious just basically because of the way their brains are wired,
mm-hmm.
and it often runs in families. And then sometimes kids have experienced severe trauma or there are family events that promote more anxiety.
I was either listening to a report on the radio or reading about this, about a child who became ill and was out of school for a couple weeks, and after that could never go back without extreme anxiety.
That, unfortunately, is very common. When kids are forced out of school for different reasons and they have anxiety, it's harder for them to go back to school. They kind of regress and get very comfortable being at home, which is confusing because when they're at home, they don't look anxious. But the idea of going to school creates tremendous anxiety.
What's the difference between general anxiety and social anxiety? Are we talking about the same thing here?
Generalized anxiety is sort of like the child who's the worrier. So this child worries about a wide variety of things. Social anxiety is different. The child doesn't worry about hurricanes or storms or going to bed at night. The child worries about performance, being around peers. Social interactions trigger anxiety. Anxiety is, it's kind of funny as a parent to look at your anxious child because in some settings the child may not be anxious at all, but then in other settings they could be extremely anxious. So it's not rational.
So the book's aimed at parents. Obviously, the title of it says that. How often is anxiety associated with the way children are parented?
And again, that's that can be looked at both ways. I think when you have an anxious child, you have to parent them differently. It's counterintuitive. Instead of being protective, you have to be pushing the child to push themselves to feel the anxiety and get to the other side of it. So you have to learn how to parent an anxious child, which is different than parenting a child who's not anxious. On the other hand, if you are an anxious parent and overprotective of your child, you could promote more anxiety in your child. That's why I wrote the book, because I think parenting an anxious child, it can be very challenging.
And we're also in this era of helicopter parenting, which may have some effect on all of this?
Yes, it promotes the idea that the child cannot be independent. And then that makes the child feel more anxious because they're not given the confidence that they could take risks and possibly fail, because the mom or dad are always watching them and making sure that they don't fail.
Long-term surveys of mental health have shown that the average kid today is more anxious than their counterparts were who were hospitalized in the 1950s. And I'm wondering, are we changing what our definition is of this? And why the increase anyway?
Well, unfortunately, that's a question that nobody really has a solid answer for. up to at least 30% of all children are diagnosed with an anxiety disorder, and many go undiagnosed and untreated. I think common sense tells us that we live in very anxious times right now, and kids are exposed to more things than they were in the past due to the social media. I mean, young kids have phones and they get alerts about terrorism that happens halfway across the world. Kids are exposed to far more than often they can handle, and that, I think, is a factor in the anxiety, not to mention the cyberbullying, all the pressures that are on our kids right now, and the state of anxiety that I think a lot of parents feel in this culture.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about how to calm your anxious child. My guest is Dr. Kathleen Trainer. She's the author of a new book on the topic. It's entitled Calming Your Anxious Child's Words to Say and Things to Do. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Trainer, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. How you parent an anxious child change over time from when they're preschool, early elementary versus a high school kid?
Well, usually I think with preschoolers, when a child is anxious, you have to learn again to try to support them, nurture them, and push them a little bit and have them push themselves. As the child gets older, often the anxiety can worsen if it has not been addressed. So with an adolescent, you're worrying more about other issues, including substance abuse, self-medicating of the anxiety. So parenting becomes more urgent, I think, as the child gets older and continues to have anxiety. If you intervene and learn how to parent an anxious child when they're younger, the child is learning strategies at a relatively young age to help them to manage their anxiety as they get older. So the ideal thing is to get help or to learn how to parent an anxious child when they're younger and teach them skills so that they can reduce their anxiety over time.
Is there an issue in relationships, you know, in the parents' relationships with each other when it comes to helping a child with anxiety? Can it exacerbate it if you don't agree, if you're not on the same page?
You have to be on the same page, and not just in the same book, but on the same page, because you have to be a parenting team working with your child. And my approach is all about how we work together to help the child. And it's complicated because anxiety is often very genetic. So you may have one parent who has anxiety themselves and one who doesn't. And the parent with anxiety may be more understanding and sometimes more overprotective than the parent without the anxiety, who may not really understand it but may be more able to set limits. So both parents have to get on the same page and approach the child together. Otherwise, the child will play one against the other and nothing will happen to help the child with the anxiety.
Annie in Columbus, you're on the air with Dr. Kathleen Trainer. Hi, Annie.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I was calling. I've got a daughter who's kind of had bouts of anxiety on and off. She's seventh grader now. But you were talking about the media, and I kind of wonder sometimes, like, how much exposure is okay? You know, I don't want to totally shelter them from the news, but on the other hand, I don't want to give her more to feed into her brain.
That's a good question, and I think you have to judge that on an individual basis with your own child in terms of their age and developmental level. Especially at seventh grade, they're starting to learn about current events, and that's very important. And the hope is that she could manage learning about events in the world, but keep it in perspective and not feel like something that happened in Iraq is going to happen in her backyard. So it's really understanding your own child. And also keep in mind that all children can be traumatized by violent images being seen over and over again. I think the violent images can be very haunting for most children.
Annie, thanks a lot for that call. If anybody else has a question for Dr. Trainer, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What about medications?
When the anxiety is so severe that the child really can't apply the strategies because they're so flooded with anxiety and it's interfering with their functioning, then my opinion is that the medication can be very effective to reduce the anxiety so that they can benefit from the therapy. I never like medication personally to be done as a first resort.
Mm-hmm.
I like it as a last resort because I've seen many anxious children respond very well to therapy. And if you'd put them on the medicine, you would have thought it was the medicine that was helping when in fact it was the cognitive behavioral therapy. So I always like to try kids with the therapy first. But if they really are so anxious that they can't apply relaxation skills, then you really want to help them to reduce the anxiety so they can function and they can really take advantage of the therapy.
How do you know when therapy is right? And boy, finding a therapist is tough because there's a shortage as it is.
Well, cognitive behavioral therapy is the evidence-based therapy for children with anxiety.
Okay.
And cognitive behavioral therapy is teaching children to think differently about their anxious feelings and then to change their anxious behavior. So I would recommend that you look for a cognitive behavioral therapist who specializes in anxiety. And it's extremely effective. You should see the results. It should be measured, and kids and parents can see that the anxiety is getting better and better and better through using these skills and strategies.
In your book, you write that a fear might be silly, but you should never tell a child experiencing fear that they are silly. And that kind of goes along with the whole issue of just acknowledging feelings in general, right?
Yes. What I'm trying to do with this silly worry is helping children to understand that there are real worries, like I'm in the street and a car is coming, and then there are silly worries, like worrying that a monster is under the bed. So if kids can grasp that, sometimes we also use the term fake fear. There are real fears where you are in danger and then, quote, fake fears. So it's helping kids to understand what, as adults, we know as rational anxiety and irrational anxiety. Once they can label it, they're taking the power out of the fear, and that helps kids.
It kind of, you know, when I look back, and so probably a lot of people may be doing this at the childhood, you know, you're worried about something under the bed or something in the closet. And I never got up to tell my parents about it. I would sit there, lay there in bed, paralyzed, but would never. The next morning, I'd get up and everything would be fine. I mean, what was I doing there? What's going on there? Is that how you're learning to manage your fears?
I think it is. I think the problem is the kids who are so afraid that now they're sleeping with their mom and dad, and they feel in tremendous danger in their bed. I mean, what you did is you stayed in your bed, mm-hmm. and you realized that
eventually
there's no monster under there. If there was, something would have happened.
Uh-huh.
So I think you did exactly what I would hope kids would do, which is to tolerate the anxiety and realize that nothing bad has happened. The problem is kids who can't sleep because of this, who are running into their parents' bed over and over again, who won't even go in their bed because they're so convinced that there's a monster under the bed.
Dawn in Worthington, you're on the air with Dr. Trainer. Hi, Dawn.
Hi. Hey, so I have two girls that have some extreme anxiety behaviors. And when they were little, it was a lot easier to just pick them up and, you know, they could cry, they could weep, but I could put them in the car and get them to school. Now they're big and it's not so easy to force them out the door to school. And we're dealing with some, you know, truancy issues and school refusal behavior, and the school's getting a lot better about helping us, but I struggle with that and wondered if you had any ideas.
That's also a very good question because I deal with this a lot every day in my practice. First of all, I think the schools and everyone has to understand that this is not a behavioral problem. It's not a child being stubborn or being oppositional, even though they may look that way. It's an issue of anxiety, and we can't, with an anxious child, you can't push them or they will push back. You have to think about incentives, rewards, helping them to push themselves, and making sure that the goals are reasonable. So, for example, the first step may be just to go through those doors and get into school, even if they can't go to classes yet, and give them incentives and rewards for doing it. Use strategies like having them listen to music or use anything that will help them to get their mind off the anxiety and to talk back to the anxiety in terms of telling themselves that school is a very safe place. So the goals have to be reasonable for the child. The child has to buy into it, and parents have to make home not so comfortable. Because if the child is allowed to be up all night and sleep all day, which does happen when kids are not in school, or if they're allowed to watch TV and be on the screens all day, that's going to be harder for them to move out of to go into school.
And that's so hard to enforce when you have a working parent. You know, when both parents have to work, it's really
very
hard to make the home life uncomfortable.
Very hard. You know, and that's where you really want the school to be as involved as possible to help you.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your help.
Dawn, take care.
Thank you.
Yep. Wendy in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Wendy.
Hi. I am calling. Full disclosure, I have always been an anxious person. So I have a six-year-old son who right now is in first grade. He has a language disability on top of his anxiety. So what we're dealing with is tears every morning before school, but he can't articulate to me what the fear is. So I'm hesitant about therapy, if that would even help, or what are some strategies I can do to get him through the morning and off to school so he has a good day at least.
So assuming that you have a good sense that school is not a problem, that he's in a supportive environment, that there's nothing at school that is stressing him out, and with his language disability, you want to make sure that he's getting enough support at school, and you have to be convinced that school is, in fact, a good match for him. Given that, then what you want to do is really help him to just label his anxiety, give it a word. He can make up a word, and then give him things that will help him to get his mind off of it. Mm-hmm. Using music is great, any kind of distraction. So it's almost like he can't be thinking about this and be anxious at the same time. Mm-hmm. And then setting very concrete goals for him. Mm-hmm. Like a goal could be a simple one of you can't talk about school or you can't say, I hate school, I'm not going to school in the morning, that kind of thing. And we would assume that once he gets to school, he's happy and everything goes well. Mm-hmm. So it's really, he doesn't have to articulate what it is that he's afraid of, because lots of times at that age, they don't know what they're afraid of. Even kids who have superior language abilities, they just know that they feel scared. Mm-hmm. And it's irrational. It doesn't make any sense. So again, once we know that, in fact, it is irrational, and with a child with any kind of learning issue, we have to make sure that it is irrational, and it's not because the child is not getting what he or she needs at school. Once we know that, then we want to give him stickers, prizes, rewards for going to school without a fuss.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Wendy, thanks for the call. And Dr. Kathleen Trainer, thanks so much to you. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure to be on your show.
Dr. Kathleen Trainer is the author of a new book. It's entitled Calming Your Anxious Child, Words to Say and Things to Do. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Tattoos have been around for thousands of years, and they've enjoyed a resurgence in popularity, with some estimating that nearly half of adults younger than 40 have at least one tattoo. Federal health officials are concerned, however, that some tattoo inks are unsafe. Dermatologist Dr. Marie Ledger at Weill Cornell Medicine and New York Presbyterian Hospital has studied tattoo infections and removal. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Also joining us is owner and artist at Memento Tattoo and Gallery in Columbus, Carrie Aldridge. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So, Dr. Ledger, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, which has the authority to regulate tattoo ink, has released a new warning about tattoo ink. What's the concern?
Yes. Yeah, so there's been a lot more research going on lately about tattoos. As you mentioned, they are so common. Half of the adult population under the age of 40 in the United States having tattoos means that we are having a lot of people exposed to tattoo ink. And we're also sort of starting to find that the chronic reactions and the acute kinds of problems that you can have from tattoos are much more common than we used to think. So it's prompted regulatory authorities from the FDA to the EU to really start thinking more about tattoo ink safety.
So it's the ink, not the procedure.
Well, a bunch of different things can happen with tattoos, ranging from the ink to the procedure itself. So the ink used to be primarily composed historically of inorganic pigments, metals, and those kinds of things. There's been a shift in recent years towards using more organic pigments, such as azo dyes. And these, some of them can be broken down either by a body itself or based on exposure to sun into compounds that we know have toxicity. Aromatic amines. Some black inks also have polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. We know that these have the potential to be carcinogenic as well. That said, even though we know that these compounds in inks can be carcinogenic, we don't know if tattoos can be, because we haven't really studied them so much.
And they've been around for thousands of years.
Tattoos have been around for thousands of years, and they're beautiful and wonderful and an important part of our, you know, history and culture, and a wonderful way of people to express themselves, but we don't exactly know what's in the inks.
So, Carrie Aldridge, you know, I'm not sure I completely understand what Dr. Ledger just said about what's in the different inks,
okay.
But there's the organic and the inorganic, and are they like my gel pen ink?
At my shop is all organic. Which is all natural. Usually natural is vegetable based. So.
Like coming from a plant.
Yeah. So everything that we use is natural. Then mixed to make it a liquid form, mixed with witch hazel and water. So you're not getting those metal compounds and things like that. That's gonna.
Do you make your own inks or do you buy them?
No. It's all manufactured by a commercial company.
Uh huh.
Which some places are. I think New York, don't quote me on this, but New York, I think you have to have commercially manufactured pigments if you're tattooing in New York.
So, Dr. Marie Ledger, how much are tattoo inks regulated?
So they're not.
Yeah,
okay.
FDA does not.
That's
not
really
yeah,
surprising.
Only, they only look into it if there's a problem that arises.
Regulated.
So.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, and these are inks that are designed for industrial use. They're not designed to be, you know, we don't really know what happens when they're under human skin for a long time. So they're pretty much not regulated. And even though a lot of the inks now are organic and, you know, quote unquote natural, mm-hmm. People can have allergies.
Yeah,
natural products.
Yeah.
You never know.
Yeah.
There's pigment in the ink, but there are also preservatives in the ink and, you know, the water that's used in the ink. There have been some problems with contamination with the water. So
that's why it should always be distilled water that you're using in it. Yes.
Yeah,
so it's Carrie Aldridge, if I came into you, I've never had a tattoo before.
Sure.
Would you test the ink on
me
first?
No, That's usually they always advise that, but when you're going to do a tattoo, you know, you can't have them come back 2 liters with a test spot just to see how.
Go ahead.
I mean, the risk is minimal, but you just got to be aware that if you're coming to get a tattoo, there's always a risk involved in it, you know, and you should know that when you're going into getting a tattoo.
So, what kind of warnings do you give, or what do you tell people to look for after the procedure?
I mean, I usually give them an aftercare sheet, tell them how to take care of it, keep it clean. And after that, you know, it's up to them, you know. And if there is an infection that arises, it's really hard to trace back to where it came from.
Whether it was the ink or the water or whatever it might have been.
If you get tattooed at a licensed studio, it's going to be really hard to contract an infection there, you know. But after that, people go home, people that have pets, you know, it's really hard to trace back to where it might have come from.
Is that what the research is showing, what little there has been, Dr. Ledger?
Yes. Well, and Carrie's exactly right. It's very hard to kind of trace where the infection has come from. And it can come from anywhere along the process. So it can come from the ink itself. There have been cases of tattoo inks themselves contaminated with mycobacteria.
At the manufacturing level.
At the manufacturing level. It can happen at the tattoo artist level. Although, as Carrie mentioned, most places require tattoo artists to be licensed and to have some kind of training in that. It can happen at the aftercare level, where the person who has the tattoos isn't careful enough taking care of it. So tattoo infections can happen at a number of different points along the whole process.
Do you have to be licensed in Ohio, Carrie?
Yes, you do.
Okay.
Yeah. And, I mean, if you're concerned about getting a tattoo, you can always call the health department, see if the studio that you're looking at is licensed. That's always, you can do that.
Do you have, like, your license in a frame on a wall
somewhere?
Yeah,
it should be up on the wall. Yeah, it should be visible for everybody. Yeah. Yeah.
When tattoos fade, as they do over time,
sure.
What happens to the ink? Do we know where it goes?
Your body absorbs it and it passes through your body.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And do we know if when the body absorbs it, Dr. Ledger, that it also excretes it at some point?
Well, we found tattoo ink in people's lymph nodes. So we know that it's absorbed in the skin. It's absorbed through macrophages. It's absorbed through cells in the skin. But it also is cleared by the lymphatic system. And so it can be, tattoo ink is absorbed systemically, we know, which is another reason why it's important to know kind of what's in it and to know a little more about it.
Sure.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and we're talking about tattoos. With us in the studio, Carrie Aldridge, owner and artist of Memento Tattoo and Gallery, and also by phone, Dr. Marie Ledger. She's a dermatologist at Weill Cornell Medicine and New York Presbyterian Hospital. If you have a question about a tattoo, want some advice on, what to do if you're getting your first one, or what to do if you're worried about someone you know that has one and isn't taking care of it properly, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Dr. Ledger, according to one of your studies, about 1 in 10 people who get tattoos experiences problems with the tattoo, including infection, itching, swelling, and redness. And that sort of sounds like the same statistic I bet you is out there for people who get any kind of piercings, right?
So I can't compare it to the piercings data, but I was actually surprised by how high that was, just given how common tattoos are. What motivated this study is I had a couple of patients who had tattoo allergies, and the patients asked me, how common is it to have a problem with your tattoo? And looking in the literature, it's just recently that we've tried to figure that out. So I was surprised that such a large percentage of people reported problems. Now, 4% of the problems that we kind of found when we did our little survey were acute. So they came on, they lasted for a few weeks, they went away within a few months.
Okay.
Infections tend to kind of fall into that category or delayed healing. But 6% of them were these kind of issues that lasted for longer than 4 months. So that would be described as like itching, raised areas at the site, irritation. So that kind of surprised us.
I have super sensitive skin. I don't even want to go into it. It's just like, I would never add to my problems by risking a tattoo or anything like that. But are some people, when we talk about allergies, are we talking about sensitivities or are we talking about out-and-out allergies, Dr. Ledger?
Yeah, so well, a bunch of different things. Your skin can respond in a bunch of different ways to a tattoo, but you can actually be allergic to the tattoo ink.
Is it the ink or the what?
Well, see, we don't know. We don't know if it's the ink. We don't know if it's the preservatives. We don't know what it is, and everybody can be a little bit different.
And so is that an allergy like you go into anaphylactic shock kind of allergy, or one where it's a chronic problem?
So it tends to be a different category of allergy. It tends to be more kind of along the line of a poison oak-like allergy. But unlike poison oak or poison ivy, which you touch and then they kind of, you know, you don't touch them anymore and the itchy rash goes away, this is something that's underneath the skin. So, you know, when people have itchy, scaly problems, swelling at the site, it can last for a long time. Your question was a really good one about can you do a test site? Mm-hmm. One of the issues with allergies is that just like with poison oak or poison ivy, repeat exposure to a particular substance makes you more likely to be allergic to it. So
right.
It can sensitize you to it. So, and theoretically, if you're doing test spots, you could be sensitizing yourself. And I've seen patients before who've had, you know, one red tattoo done 10 years ago, no problems with it, get a second red tattoo, and they develop a rash and an allergy both to the new and the old tattoo.
See, I've never seen that before.
Yeah. Yes, it's not that common.
But there's a tipping point for some people.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Huh. Yes, but I've seen it as a dermatologist, and it's definitely something that can happen.
So I had allergy tests done some years ago, and they found out I was allergic to chocolate, among other things. And but can they find out if you're allergic to tattoo ink or tattoo anything?
Well, so sometimes when people have these reactions, people have tried to do patch testing, which is a technique that dermatologists have to try to find out if people are allergic to a substance touching the skin. But even when we know that people are allergic to the tattoos, the patch testing is not always positive, and we're not exactly sure why that is. So I think the long and the short of it is, given how common tattoos are, we need to know more about them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Carrie, can you describe sort of the standards of health you have at Memento and what you do to keep the shop clean?
Well, yeah, the health board this past year, they just revised all their codes. So all shops now have to kind of prove that they're capable of, they have all their standard precautions in place, infection control, and you have to prove that. And we have a step-by-step setup that we use. So everything is covered before we start. Everything's in place. And that's the way we do it. You know, everything's by the books. So.
Like a dentist's office
of
thing?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But cooler looking, I hope.
Yeah.
Tell us how you prep somebody for a tattoo. How does that work? What's the procedure? For someone who's never done it before, what's it like?
First, we clean their skin, shave the area. That's going to be – we use a medical-grade soap to make sure their clean is, their skin is sanitary. Then we place a stencil on, and then that's their design.
Okay.
And then we start tattooing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And have you ever had to turn anyone away who you thought, you don't look healthy. I don't really want to work on you.
If somebody has like a broken bone or something like that, you know, or other kind of health problems, you know, it's probably not a good idea to get a tattoo, just because if there is an infection, you know, your body needs to concentrate
healing.
On healing the other thing that has the problem.
Is that a pretty good idea, Dr. Ledger?
Yes, you know, I think
that's why pregnant women should stay away from
tattoos. Okay.
We did with some researchers did a survey of tattoo artists in New York City too, looking at the kinds of things that they encountered as well as the kinds of things that they were interested in learning more about. And one thing that tattoo artists often said, you know, they're kind of first line responders because they get asked a lot of questions about skin, they get asked a lot of questions about moles, they get asked a lot of questions about what should I do when things go wrong. You know, in our study in Central Park, only 30% of the people that we talked to actually saw a doctor about their tattoo complaints, and a lot of people go to their tattoo artist.
Yeah, most people come to us first.
Yes, exactly.
And most of the time it's just, you know, redness or irritated, which will happen when you get a tattoo.
It doesn't mean
you have an infection or a rash.
No.
You know, it's just normal to your skin
Someone
to be irritated
you,
for a few days. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah. But so it's kind of fun because the New York Department of Health and Hygiene invited me to give a couple lectures to their tattoo artists. And so, I was mm-hmm. kind of talking about skin cancer, how to recognize early signs of skin cancer. But, there are definitely people who probably shouldn't be getting tattoos. And
sure.
that's another great part of training for tattoo artists, just in terms of like screening people who's appropriate and who's not appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting position to be in, Carrie, because, we call you tattoo artists, you know. You're not necessarily medical personnel, but you're doing something medical.
Yeah,
a medical procedure, but you're also an artist.
Uh-huh.
So double duty. Carrie Aldridge, thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Yeah,
I appreciate
thanks for
it.
Having me.
Carrie Aldridge, he's the owner and artist of Memento Tattoo and Gallery, and also Dr. Marie Ledger, thanks to you as well.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Marie Ledger is a dermatologist at Weill Cornell Medicine and New York Presbyterian Hospital. She studies tattoos and their impact on our health. So thanks to you. Thanks to everybody today for listening and calling in. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.